Right now, you can get like 20% internal rate of return just by keeping your money in Bitcoin. That's a fairly conservative rate. Historically, it's been much higher. If you could get 20%, well, whatever investment you make better be way more than 20%, because, you know, over like 5 years or something, you're getting that 20% in the bag.
Welcome back. I am Ben Wiggins, and I'm here with Jimmy. Jimmy, what are you feeling on what's going on out there in the blockchain world, the Bitcoin world? What are you seeing? What are you seeing happening right now?
Yeah, it's kind of a strange season right now, because I think we're in between the ETF stuff and the halving. We're kind of in that in between space. For a while there, the ETF was like the big news, and there were months of leading up, like speculation leading up to it. But what we're seeing is that, you know, the ETF happened, the price sort of like dipped a little bit. There's some speculation about GBTC selling, forced selling from the FTX bankruptcy and all that. Mm-hmm. So like it didn't have the bump that I think a lot of people were wanting. But then, you know, it's starting to go back up again. And is it, you know, ETF pressure? Has the selling on the GBTC stopped because of, you know, all the bankruptcies? Or is it like just anticipation for the halving? So we're kind of in this like weird in-between state at the moment. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff going on with the COPPA trial and Craig Wright and all that stuff that's going on too. I mean, like Bitcoin always has some news here or there, but price-wise, we're kind of in that in-between state. A lot of people anticipating the halving, a lot of people just sort of having, you know, left the ETF stuff behind, maybe a little disappointing. We're kind of in a weird space.
Yeah. What would you say to someone who would take the, you know, the like the ongoing legal dramas as an excuse to say, here's why Bitcoin is bad? Like, that's, you know, someone who wanted to make that argument.
The legal drama, I guess, is much more indicative of how you can weaponize the, you know, the court system in various countries for like to sort of muck things up. And, you know, I mean, we're talking about Craig Wright and the COPPA trial, obviously. And you know, he's done quite a lot of damage suing Bitcoin developers and, you know, I guess HODLNOT and Peter McCormick and various people. But he's done a lot of damage, because there's a lot of developers that had to endure a tremendous amount of stress over the legal stuff that he was filing. It's what you would call lawfare. Does that say that Bitcoin is bad? I don't think it says anything about Bitcoin. It just says something about the legal system, particularly in the UK, which allows you to sue for libel for almost anything. And it's very favorable towards the accuser rather than the defendant. So it's, you know, there's a reason why he didn't really sue in the US. He did all his lawsuits in the UK. But, you know, I think about other stuff like the entire Mt. Gox saga. It's been about 10 years now, and it's taken such a long time for the entire thing to, you know, sort of settle, which is kind of crazy, because, you know, it should be a fairly straightforward case. It's a bankruptcy. Here's the Bitcoins that are remaining. Let's distribute it to those people. But you know, it's taken 10 years largely because of, you know, scumbags like Peter Vecesnes, who made this really, really meritless lawsuit, but sort of kept it in there to muck it up. And he ended up sort of sitting on a gold mine because there was a hedge fund that was impatient enough that they were willing to just say, here's the money to go away, and you no longer have any claims to this, but we want to speed this up so we could get our Bitcoin. And that's still like in the process of unwinding, right? Like it's only now starting to get people their Bitcoin and so on. So, I mean, the law system is extremely inefficient and very hard to, you know, deal with, and it takes a really long time, and it kind of points to why people like Bitcoin in the first place. It's like you don't have to go through all of this crap with the legal system. It's just possession is 10/10 of the law instead of 9/10, and then you have to wait for 10 years to get your other 10th or something. It's just, I like anything with law just ends up really kind of messing things up.
Let's talk more broadly about that. Like, kind of generally, one of the phrases you used, and it's a phrase that gets used a lot these days, is the corruption of fiat currency. And sort of if we look at this from, and paint with the broadest possible brush, like, where do you see that right now? Like, what makes you the most hopeful? What dismays you the most? Like, where's your head on those things?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing that I'm seeing is that most of the media, at least legacy media, seems completely captured by like Pfizer and Lockheed Martin and like defense contractors. It's crazy. I was looking at how like the ratings for a lot of these like evening shows and stuff, and very few people watch it. If you look at the stats, like whatever Tucker Carlson posts on X gets like 100 times the views of, like Rachel Maddow or whatever's on Fox News or whatever. So what's going, like the business model doesn't make sense because, to make a video on YouTube or X or Rumble is like, it gotta be like 10% of the cost for like
If that,
a news
yeah, if
studio,
that.
like you got all the producers and video cameras and live reporters and all that. Yet somehow with like one 100th of the audience, they're able to keep going. So what's going on? And like you look at the numbers, it's mostly because of the advertisers. There are certain advertisers that want their point of view, and they're not vying for eyeballs. They're vying for the actual corruption of the news media itself, and that's happening at every level. And it's gotten to the point where they're just flat out telling lies. I mean, we don't know anything about Jeffrey Epstein. We haven't been told anything about, that list of people that were on that thing. Like, no one knows anything, and there's no one even interested in the mainstream media and like pursuing that stuff. The only news we get are, people on Rumble or X or like these platforms, and it's people that don't have any money, right? Like they're just like and doing their own investigations. We get a couple of authors that are like dogged about it and really go into it, but like none of these journalists are doing any journalism because they're not incentivized to. They're more or less propaganda arms of the establishment at this point, probably like some combination of giant companies and government deep state agencies or something like that. And that's entirely really funded by fiat money, because you get the approval of the FDA on a drug. Well, that means that you can make many, many billions of dollars, and that's like money essentially that is granted to you because, the FDA wants to fast track it or something. It's such a corrupt system, and so much of that is printed money, granted money, government picking winners and losers, and unsurprisingly, the incumbents are the winners, the people that keep getting chosen to win. So you get this very corrupt system, and it's almost kind of laughable at this point how obvious it is. And I think most people can kind of sense it, whether you're on the left or the right. Like there's it's so obvious that they're, for example, cheering for more war, and cheering for more, government subsidies of, countries where we don't have that much interest. Like why do we need to spend however many billions to Ukraine? Yet it's like both parties seem to want to do it, but if you ask the constituencies left and on the right, like nobody wants to send them money. So what, like why is there this divide? Well, it's fiat money, and there's a lot of people playing this game that are benefiting from it.
Let me push back on this just a little bit. So you're talking about a system, kind of where the incumbents keep winning, and like, yeah, there's some degree of that. But if you look at, so just taking like a super simple example, if you look at, like drug companies are like biggest businesses over the course of, you know, 50 years or something like that. Like go back to the, you know, 70s, 60s, 50s. The like companies that were the biggest then, like there's definitely some inertia to that. But over time, you know, like all of most of those companies, I guess, other than maybe Disney, I mean, yeah, Coke is still big, but it's not like it's not one of the giants now. You know, now like internet companies are the biggest ones, you know, they're and companies that own operating systems, you know, Microsoft, Apple, that sort of thing. So I guess, I mean, I agree with you. Like there's a lot of, you know, the incumbents continue to win, like you said, but I do think that, that the business landscape in the long term, like there's a lot of meritocracy to it. And you're, it seems like I'm not getting that sense from you. Like, do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I do disagree with that. The companies that tend to win are the ones that get access to fiat money. So, I mean, you know, we talk about, I mean, if you look at maybe the last 20 years, you really only have, you know, three large companies. And this is what every VC portfolio sort of like, kind of won on. It's Google, Facebook, and maybe NVIDIA. NVIDIA has been around a while, but they, you know, sort of like caught the wave of like, you know, having lots of processors and stuff like that. But most of the other stuff, you know, these were companies that were fueled by fiat money. You know, Facebook wasn't first, but they certainly raised a heck of a lot of money. And, you know, to be fair, they did figure out scale before a lot of the other platforms too. Most people know that Friendster existed before.
Yeah, Zanga
was popular as well. But like the reason Friendster didn't go through was because they had performance problems. They didn't know how to scale and stuff like that. And you know, they Facebook obviously used the ability to scale quickly, and they had the technical competence to do it. But a large part of their success wasn't, you know, natural, I would say. They got tremendous injections of money through, you know, fundraising through VCs. And, you know, I argue in the book that VC money comes from, you know, Cantillon effects from loans. And if you know how the entire VC industry works, the way it works is you get money from LPs. And then they essentially act like a bank, right? Like they're capital handlers, they're money changers. They collect money on one side and they essentially trade for equity, but it's really more like a loan because they get first preference on like any liquidation and stuff like that. But that money comes from the LPs. And where do the LPs get it? Well, they have some assets or something, you know, maybe they own land or something or a business or a painting or whatever. What they do is they get loans against those assets and then use those to fund the invest in these VC funds. So ultimately, the money comes from nothing because these are loans that are given by these banks that come out of nothing against an asset that you might have, but it's still the same. It's newly printed money that that has no opportunity cost for anybody. So it's all newly printed money that gets into that fuels these startups. Oftentimes, this means that profitability is sacrificed at the expense of scale. And once you get to scale, the time when you really make money is when you have a monopoly, and you especially on attention, and you're pretty much the only game in town, and you can use that to your advantage to make a significant amount of money. But that's sort of like the formula for growth in all of these industries over like say the past 50 years, ever since like VC money got big and stuff like that. Before that, it was all profit-driven. Instead, most of these businesses have been using debt-fueled growth, which is bringing consumption forward and putting off profits later and later until they have essentially a monopoly, and then they can use their market power to essentially charge more money than, you know, they would otherwise get. So it's not really a meritocracy. I really don't think so. If it were, you'd have a lot smaller companies. You'd have a lot more differentiated companies. Instead of one giant search engine or one giant social network, I think you'd have a lot more niche products and things that are better for the user and aren't so exploitive of people's privacy and things like that. So yeah, I mean that's the way I see it. I really don't think a lot of what we've been seeing is really meritocracy as much as it is VCs, Cantillon winners, governments, people like that sort of picking the winners and losers.
Okay, so what is it about the nature of fiat currency? I mean, obviously a government can print it anytime they want, but is it just that, or is there something that is, that is kind of endemic to the way in which they're deciding like when to print versus not print the money? And that's that.
Well, so all money is printed through loans, right? All money is all printed money is debt, and the way it enters the economy is through some sort of a loan. So if I have a $50 million building, I can get a $40 million loan. 80% loan to value on real estate is relatively normal, and you can go get that from a commercial bank or some retail bank or whatever. And that now I can take that 80% and go invest it. And as long as I'm outrunning the interest rate, then I'm making money. Now, when you're near 0% interest rates, almost anything will make money. So you're going to take more of a risk and, or I mean, you'll take that deal all day long on the loan, and that's money printed on your behalf. That's how money comes into existence. More and more money, and you monetize more and more things. So, you have. Like a lot of people think, for example, like Mark Zuckerberg must, buy things with cash. He does nothing of that kind. There was a story about how he bought like four plots, like around the house that he owned, all of the houses around it, so he could have more privacy or expand his house or something like that. And, what we found out was that he got a mortgage. It's like, why does Mark Zuckerberg need to get a mortgage? Well, he can. First of all, he doesn't want to sell his Facebook stock to go and fund this. Instead, he gets a loan against his Facebook stock. And of course, because these Facebook stocks are expected to go up higher, and because he has so much of it, he was able to negotiate like a mortgage at like 1.5%. Now, like the best, mortgage rates that you and I could get, even if we had a lot of money in the bank, is at this point, it's like maybe 7% or something like that. And even like 5 years ago, it would have been like 3%, maybe 2.5% at like the if you timed it absolutely perfectly. But people like Mark Zuckerberg, they get like 1.5%, right? Like this is what happens, is that most really rich people are actually like most of their wealth is from newly printed money. It's loans that they get off of the assets that they have. And this is the advantage that you have in a fiat economy. So they use that, and those go to VCs, and then those go get funneled to startups and everything else. But the bigger dynamic at play is this problem of capital allocation. And this has always been kind of a problem in any sort of like money printing system, anywhere where you have this like opportunity cost less money, right? Like where if you can just put money to something and you can just go get more of it if it doesn't work out, basically. There's no opportunity cost to it because it's not scarce. So a lot of money like that. Well, there's way too much of the investment dollars, and like allocating it actually becomes a fairly difficult problem because there just aren't enough things, because anything worthwhile gets oversubscribed by a significant amount, and you get way too much money going toward it, and you have all this other money that wants to invest in something, but there's I mean, when you have an infinite supply of money and there's some fixed demand of startups or something like that, the price of these things goes up, so you get this problem of capital allocation. You don't know which ones are legit and so on. So you get like a lot of spray and pray behavior from a lot of VCs or even family offices and stuff. They'll buy one of everything and try, get exposure to everything. They get obsessed with some sort of diversification or whatever. But I mean, really, this is because of all of the loans and money that's available. And sometimes you could get significant leverage if your asset is considered pristine or whatever. So you get weird sort of dynamics around all of that, and you end up funding things that become popular, that become sort of like a proxy for whether or not it's a good investment. And that can be the case if a lot of people do due diligence. That isn't the case, though. And you kind of saw that with stuff like WeWork, where, you know, a lot of people piled into it because it seemed popular, but the business model never really made sense. And it was like a hard real estate play and stuff like that. So you get essentially slick salesmen that get access to all this money because like they're best at selling themselves to like these money managers. That's what you have to do. Instead of, you know, entrepreneurs who are selling, you know, goods to the market, it's you know, slick salesmen that are selling themselves to capital allocators. So there's a lot of like proxies that a lot of VCs and people like that use, like, okay, what school did you go to? Were you employed at Google or whatever? And like, those aren't necessarily very good things, but those are the people that end up getting funded over and over. So it becomes like massively unfair because in a meritocratic economy, you get all kinds of people that find unexpected success because they have a good nose for what the market wants. But, you know, in sort of like a gatekept, like VC-funded economy, it's nothing like that. It becomes way more socialist in many ways because the people doing the choosing might not be from the Politburo, but it's capital allocators that honestly aren't that much smarter. And, you know, they like to, you know, pretend that they're, you know, super awesome at everything and can give you the world's best advice and stuff. I've been at a lot of these startups. So like these guys don't know what the hell they're talking about. And, you know, they spout words like blockchain and crypto. And like that's like an instant tell for me that they don't know what the hell they're talking about. And they're just talking out of their ass. And honestly, a lot of them are like that. And this is the giant problem in sort of like where the money goes, because it's going to a lot of wrong places. What we call malinvestment is happening all over the economy. And you kind of get the consequences, which are stagnation, right? You get essentially like same companies that are subsidized or held up, and same technologies that are kept going for the sake of, you know, keeping them alive rather than like allowing new technologies to flourish. You know, I mean, you could have like nuclear jet engines and nuclear car engines and stuff like that back probably in the 60s if we actually care to study them, but no one did. There were all kinds of regulations against it so that the incumbents could continue their you know, profitability. They didn't want any threats to it, so there were regulations put up against it. So, you know, I mean, we're still running on like you know, gas powered engines on a lot of this stuff, despite the fact that nuclear has like many orders of magnitude more energy density and, you know, all kinds of better properties in every way. But, you know, none of that gets developed because, you know, there are regulations and moats put around them.
This is something you're not going to have any trouble convincing me of. going back to the opportunity cost, right? So your argument is taking the opportunity cost from, you know, N to zero, like, has it, like it fundamentally changes the way that everyone operates. So my question is, the counter argument would be, where actually is the opportunity cost threshold where that starts to flip? And I'm not, so I am not convinced that creating scarcity for the money supply would, you know, that what basically what Bitcoin does, and what you know, I'm sure that many other cryptocurrencies are doing the same thing or aiming for the same thing.
I mean, they're centralized though, so like it's completely not believable or credible for the future. But I mean, I think the question you're asking is basically you're questioning whether or not you know, the additional investment by having opportunity costless money, like whether or not that's helpful or not to an economy. And I would argue that it's not, because people spend money that they get for free very differently than money that they've saved.
Yeah.
And if they're and that and that's just plain
No,
true.
yeah,
And
I'm not
you
going to
kind
argue
of see it
that.
in like the in the startup world. Like if you're a founder and you're getting funded by, through angel rounds or, pre-seed, seed, whatever, and you get a bunch of money, I mean, most of the time they spend it very frivolously and stupidly, and you could kind of see it. Now they're things have gotten a little different because interest rates have been going up. So, I read about one startup that had something like $5 million in the bank, that they raised in the last round right before the pandemic or something like that, and they had a significant amount of money. So what they've done to extend the runway is they've been matching their spending with the interest that they're getting off of the money that they have in the bank. And if you have $5 million, that like you and you get like 6 or 7%, or if you can find those returns, or even
Yeah, I mean
5%, which I think you can get in some bank
that's
accounts.
anywhere.
You know, 5% of $5 million is what, like
What, 250?
5%.
250K?
I mean, it's not a small amount of money, and that's enough to like fund you for a while, and sort of keep going with it. And if you have even more money, you can play that game more. But for a while there, what was happening is, you would spend on all kinds of stuff that you didn't necessarily need, that the VCs told you that you needed, some subscription to this, and maybe ping pong tables in the break room and free snacks,
Culture.
and just kind of stupid stuff that you end up spending frivolously because it's not really your money. It's kind of like a guy that won a big at the casino or something, and he's like buying rounds for everybody, Cristal for everybody, right? Like whatever, like that's kind of the mentality that you get into, and it's misallocated resources. Whereas if it's your own savings, you're going to be very careful about how you spend your money, and that's been the case in a lot of places. Like in the past, but with VC money, with opportunity costless money, you get sort of like a frivolity to money where people don't treat the money that they have very
I agree
seriously.
with that.
And that leads to kind of bad outcomes,
My
essentially.
yeah, I agree with that for sure. My argument is that you're still going to get stupid decisions a lot of the time, regardless of whether you're dealing with a fiat currency or a restricted, a limited currency, scarce. But I guess I think my argument is that this problem, I don't think this problem goes away because it's if you switch it, like if we were to just go with a decentralized currency, if fiat money were to disappear tomorrow, I think you would run into a lot of the same gatekeeping type of situations. Like scarcity helps, but I don't think it solves the problem.
Well, so here's how it's different. First of all, there's a much higher hurdle rate under a Bitcoin standard. So right now you can get, I think very conservatively speaking, like 20% internal rate of return just by keeping your money in Bitcoin, right? And that's a fairly conservative rate. Historically, it's been much
Oh, yeah.
higher. So like if you could get 20%, well, whatever investment you make better be way more than 20%, because you probably, over like 5 years or something, you're getting that 20% in the back. So, okay, so what investments are you going to make? A lot of these investments are completely stupid and have no hope of returning anything like that. So, first of all, a lot of this stuff doesn't get funded. So what's the alternative? Well, I think what happens is people save instead, and they use that internal rate of return on Bitcoin for their own advantage. And instead of raising money for 2 years, you work for four, you save up, and you use your own money to do the startup that you wanted to do. And it's of course the quality of the startup is going to be significantly higher because the hurdle is going to be higher. It's your money. It's and you're going to want to make a profit almost from the beginning. It's no lose money for 8 years and then hope to exit through the public markets or something like that. It's very different. And if you have stuff like that, you don't necessarily need to go through the gatekeepers. And I think that's the world we're going to get to, because as you reduce sort of the money being printed out of nothing, you increase the wealth of everybody else, right? Because all of that money being printed out of nothing ultimately comes from savers, and instead that money is going towards savers. And if you do save, well, now you have it, and it's in the hands of somebody that's more or less earned it. Of course you're going to get stupid decisions and money spent on dumb things and businesses that go bankrupt, but you know, it's money that they accumulated. It's not anyone else's money. It's not money created out of nothing. It's not debasing the dollar in some way or whatever. Instead, it's the entrepreneur that took the risk, made bad decisions, and they lose their money. But at the same time, if it's the entrepreneur that does well and they create a good or service that's good for everybody, well, then they're the ones that get all the upside as well. Instead of these VCs that are essentially middlemen in the money game that are somehow still taking 2 and 20 every time. Like that's an enormous tax for an entrepreneur, where a significant amount of that money should be coming to them. Now, like it's a little bit weird, and the way the system's set up, you need to become a unicorn or $1 billion+ company for anybody to get any return. And you know, at that point, it's like, okay, giving up 20% doesn't sound so bad because you're making so much money already. But you know, it's the market in that case essentially selects for only those types of companies. And all evidence is that you need all kinds of different companies at all kinds of different sizes for an economy to function normally. And instead, you have this path where only $1 billion companies get made. And if you're not that, then we're not interested. It leads to a very unhealthy economy where they're all kind of playing these fiat games instead of, you know, the mom and pop stores of yesteryear. You know, like a lot of people, I think, would run businesses of their own because they know about a lot of stuff if they had the opportunity, but they don't have the opportunity to save. Their savings is being debased away from them. It ends up in the hands of VCs who are investing in these startups that are losing lots of money, and a lot of that money is malinvested. Essentially, the opportunity costless money costs the opportunity of the people that would be starting businesses. So it would come back to them, and it would help them.
So my argument, so a couple of things. First, we saw a downtick in the number of like companies and the number of like, I guess, publicly traded companies anyway. And I would say in general, the number of companies after Sarbanes-Oxley passed. But now like there's, you know, I think we have more companies and more publicly traded companies in the U.S. than at any time in our history. So we may still be slightly below where we were in like 2000, 2001, 2002. But I think we've passed those numbers again. And I think we're way, way above where we would have been in like, I don't know, call it 1915, you know, like the youth, you know, young days of the, you know, the stock exchange and of stock exchanges and things like that. So is your argument?
Yeah, and think about how well they're doing, right? Like, I think if you take out like the top seven companies of the S&P 500, we're actually down.
Yeah,
right? they're all doing really kind of poorly. The fact that you have a lot of large companies doesn't really speak to anything other than that there's lots of large companies. We kind of already knew that. What that does tell me is that there are a lot of smaller companies that probably don't exist as a result of a lot of these large companies that have taken up the resources that would be going towards them.
Yeah.
So it's not really necessarily a good thing that you have a large number of public companies, especially with all the regulations and stuff, because that's energy that's be taken away from other things. Mm-hmm. The thing about economics is you have to always be looking at the unseen costs rather than just what exists. There's a cost to having so many companies that exist that are large, that are publicly regulated, that have all of this, regulatory regime around them and so on. It's not necessarily a good thing.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. The other thing I wanted to touch on is you mentioned, like a 20% internal rate of return. And I do agree with you. Historically, it's been much, much, much higher than that. But what's the terminal internal rate of return though? Like you could, I don't know what it is, but, and I haven't heard anybody project kind of where that could end up in the long term, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean that it's hard to measure because we don't have the meter in economics, right? Like where I'm just giving like rough numbers based on the US dollar, cause that's what everyone uses as a unit of account for a lot of this stuff. But we don't really have a meter, and in fact, I would argue that Bitcoin is the closest thing we have to a meter. So you're not going to measure it against yourself itself. I mean, at that point, it's just like one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin. But what I do suspect is that the rate at which things get better is what would accrue to the dominant currency. So if you think about about the monetary expansion rate of the US dollar, and that is the dominant form of currency currently in the world today. It's been, if you look at the expansion rate over the last 65 years or so, it's been about 7% a year. So the M2 money supply has grown at a steady growth of 7% a year, which is not the CPI number that you know, and in fact, the CPI number has both been higher and lower, but mostly lower throughout its history. So, you get 2%, 3%. I think the Biden administration is trying to argue that it's like 3.6% right now or something. But, it's always like significantly lower than that. Well, what's the difference there? The difference there is the sort of productivity gain we're getting from innovations and new market processes and stuff like that. So if you get you get some supply chain improvement, right, where you're replacing some part from Malaysia and instead going to Vietnam and getting it for a little cheaper or something like that, that's a productivity gain that goes all the way up the chain. The 3 or 4% difference between the monetary expansion rate and inflation, that's the degree to which things are just sort of improving on a general scale on a yearly basis. So I think that is maybe, that's the current rate of improvement. Now, I don't know what it would be under Bitcoin. I suspect that it would be significantly higher because you correct a lot of the incentives, like I said before, of entrepreneurship and doing, like, instead of wasting a lot of money and giving it to Harvard grad grads that went to Google or something like that, and instead it's entrepreneurs that have their own savings and take risks and do so that way. I think the rate of return, I guess, in terms of productivity, of improvement, things like that, it would probably end up 15-20% as well. I don't know. That's my gut feeling. I do know that things were improving way faster during 1870 to 1910 than say 1990 to 2020. Other than you have like a few gadgets that you can navel gaze at, like you didn't have like the step functions in improvement like the airplane or the railroad or oil power and energy and things like that. Like none of those things, like we've basically not really explored any of that, and it's even despite that, we're still getting maybe 2-4% productivity improvement or like standard of life improvement, I guess, through like all the brilliant human ingenuity that that's percolating through the economy. So, yeah, I don't know what it is, but I suspect it's significantly higher than it is right now.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe. I mean, I would. So, in the case of the Second Industrial Revolution, kind of the 1870 to 1910 period, I would argue that that's sort of its own, that period in history is kind of its own thing, and to me, it's was just kind of, I mean, chance as much as anything that happened when it did, relative to, say, the First Industrial Revolution. Like, you just get these, pops throughout history. And I definitely agree with you. During that period, we had much higher, you know, marginal gains on a year-by-year basis. I mean, that was maybe when quality of life improved the most in a single 40-year period in the entire lifespan of Earth.
I mean, it's possible that it was a one-time step function or something like that, but my gut feeling is that that wasn't it at all. First of all, you didn't have that many taxes. You didn't have all of the rent-seeking. You had a hard money, value accrued to the savers and so on. So you had stuff like the Erie Canal being completely funded by private funds. There was no public funds spent on it whatsoever. Whereas nowadays, like, there's public funding for almost everything and it ends up dominating it. And you get, not surprisingly, you get giant cost overruns and things like that as a result. But, you know, back then you had a lot less rent seeking, so a lot more of the profit went to the actual entrepreneur, which meant that there was more motivation and more people innovating as a result of that. And if you were able to make some innovation, you would get paid for it. Whereas right now, a lot of innovations you're not going to get paid for, or it's going to get co-opted, or it's going to get copied. And, you know, I mean, the patents and copyrights are a complete joke. So you're like, whoever has the money is going to win regardless of who invents it. So it's this weird system where the incentives are not aligned for the entrepreneur. And as a result, you're not getting that much, entrepreneurship or inventions or innovation or whatever. And this is the entrepreneurial energy that's being sucked dry by fiat money, unfortunately. And I think once you take away a lot of these bad incentives of fiat money, then you get a lot of that energy back. Now, how long does it take? Or, you know, what other juice can we squeeze from, like, the technological revolutions that we've already had? I think there's plenty. I mean, just in nuclear alone, I feel like there would be enormous strides that are able to be made in all kinds of areas. Like, imagine if your car didn't have to fuel for 20 years, how different everything would be. How much real estate would be cleared up just in gas stations? Right, like, how
you're not gonna have any trouble convincing me of the value of nuclear.
Yeah, I mean, how much how much more productivity could you get if you had nuclear jet engines that could fly three times faster, and, you know, you can go from New York to Mumbai in 8 hours instead of 20? Right, like those are the kinds of things that, like, no one's really explored, or, you know, like, that haven't been allowed to be explored, that have more or less been suppressed. Even in the best times, like, it takes a lot of effort and time and energy for an inventor and the right people to come up with this stuff, with all of the burdens that are stacked on top, with taxes, with all the different rent seekers and regulations and all of that stuff. It's very little motivation, because there's a good chance that the invention gets stolen away from you, and that you don't get to make that much money, and that, everything ends up kind of crappy anyway, or it gets suppressed or whatever. So there's so many ways in which there's so much friction in a fiat economy that prevents innovation that, I think if you take a lot of those away, I think you'd be surprised at the level of ingenuity most people would have.
So then, would you argue that if we had remained as a country on the gold standard, would these problems not exist?
Probably. I would expect us to be significantly more technologically advanced had we stayed on the gold standard. obviously we didn't, and it's hard to know what would have been. But we do know that, you know, under the gold standard, we had significant innovation, and we had a lot of 0-to-1 moments, whereas a lot of the things in the 20th century, 21st century, it's like at best like 1-to-1.5 or something like that. It's improvements on things that already exist. Even the internet is really an extension of the telegraph, right? Like that, and you know, the spaceships are an extension of, you know, like the Wright brothers airplane or whatever. Yeah. It's not like anything that genuinely new. The quantum leaps that we're talking about, like, generally tend to happen when you give a lot of these entrepreneurs freedom and things like that. You used to have Nikola Teslas and you know, Thomas Edisons of the world. It's not a surprise that they sort of like came up from that era, because that was the ethic back then. I think we have probably brilliant minds like that right now. It's just that, you know, I mean, they're probably like quants at a hedge fund, or, you know, like doing a scammy Web3 startup, or, you know, day trading at home or something, like, or playing poker. I don't know. Like they're doing that instead of this other stuff because the incentives are not aligned.
Fair enough. Any final thoughts you want to share, Jimmy, before we conclude today?
Well, I mean, it's a rather sad commentary that a lot of people are not sort of being their best selves, right? And I think people want to be productive and do a lot of these things, but instead, like they get sort of shuffled into rent-seeking roles, and it's I find that really sad, and in a way, a waste of human potential. And you know, like I think most people would rather live their best life rather than sort of like this rent-seeking existence that many of them end up doing. So, you know, this is where like the hope for Bitcoin is for me, is that there is a way out of these bad incentive systems, and it's with Bitcoin. And the thing is, like, it's coming. I think it's inevitable. And you know, once it does come, then a lot of these incentives get fixed. Now, there's going to be a lot of turbulence between now and then. But, you know, that's, I think, the world that we need to prepare for, the, you know, skating to where the puck is going instead of where it is right now.
Definitely hear that. Well, to the viewers, thank you for thanks for tuning in to join us. And you'll see Jimmy again for sure. And maybe you'll see me again too. So, Jimmy, thanks for the time. Appreciate the conversation.